Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And girls learn at a pretty young age about rape and that no means no. They also learn from older women that drinking publicly in scantily clad outfits draws the wrong kind of male attention. But the implicit attitude that women, instead of men, are responsible for preventing rape is being challenged anew by those who want female sexual empowerment to be more a part of the discussion about rape. Joining me now are two members of what they consider to be a new guard of feminists who are trying to move the conversation from no means no to yes means yes. Performer and activist Jacqueline Friedman is the co-author of a new book called Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape. And LaToya Peterson, editor of the blog Racialicious and a contributor to the book with an essay called The Not Rape Epidemic. Welcome both of you to WNYC. Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Jacqueline, tell me why you decided to put this book together now. It's certainly not a new idea that men are the ones who should be held responsible for rape.
It's true. The immediate genesis for the book was an article that was published on Women's E! News, which was the same retread of women shouldn't go out and drink and be scantily clad, they might get themselves raped, which is a construct that leaves men entirely out of the equation. And what was shocking about that article was not the content, we see that all the time, but that it was on a feminist news outlet. And so Jessica Valenti, my co-editor, and I got together and said, you know, enough is enough. And we pulled together a lot of people who've been doing thinking and writing about this in various and sundry places to put together this anthology.
And the old feminist adage that rape is less about sex than it is about power, you don't disagree with this, but you say it doesn't go far enough.
It doesn't go far enough. No means no is crucial for rape prevention. Women need to be believed and listened to when they say no to sex. But that no is meaningless if women don't also have access to sex. What we're saying is, in order for the culture to recognize and punish rape adequately, it needs to be clear whether a woman's having a good time having sex or not. It's not enough that she didn't say no. We should all be held to a standard where we need to pay attention to our partners in bed, whether they actually are enthusiastically wanting to be there. And if they're not, we need to stop. No means no doesn't go far enough.
LaToya Peterson, you're one of 27 contributors to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you write an essay called The Not Rape Epidemic. And you write, we learned a lot about rape. What we weren't prepared for was everything else. Rape was something we could identify, an act with a strict definition and two distinct scenarios. Not rape was something else entirely. I think it's related to what Jacqueline was just saying, actually. So what do you mean by not rape?
Well, when I talked about not rape, the reason I wrote the essay for Jacqueline's book was because I have not been raped, thank goodness. And yet there were still all of these things in my history and in the history of women that I knew growing up, that there were just all these things that happened to us sexually that didn't fall under the boundaries of traditional rape. And that's what essentially people would define rape as, some kind of unwanted sexual encounter that resulted in penetration that you protested against. And then all these other things like sexual assault or statutory rape or just being molested or groped or coerced into having sex weren't really covered. So what I found happening was that there were a lot of women who had these kind of very negative sexual experiences that shaped their ideas about sexuality and healthy sexuality, but weren't being talked about because they didn't fit into the narrative of what a rape should be.
So it happened to a lot of your friends in different ways. As you say, it happened to you. Do you want to tell your story, not to be graphic, but because maybe it'll help other people or because there's an important message here since you write it in the book?
Definitely. It was a very difficult thing for me to write because a lot of our training is to put these things aside because it's not rape, because that kind of severe action wasn't taken, that it doesn't matter in a sense. So we're always taught to kind of bury these things and not talk about them. And one of the great reactions about posting the essay and posting the original version that I put on my website, Racialicious, was seeing, like, I believe 70,000 people read it, and so many women commented with their same stories. But anyway, my story was essentially that I was sexually assaulted when I was going into middle school. So I was about 12 years old, and I was home alone. And a friend of a friend, there was a guy that I used to know and hang out with all the time, and one of his friends came and knocked on my balcony door and asked me, had I seen that friend, the person who I referred to as T in the book. And, you know, I said no. And I didn't see anything necessarily wrong with this setup. I was home alone, but I knew this person casually, and he was asking for someone else we knew. I mean, it was a, you know, normal setup. So I opened the door, and I told him, you know, I hadn't seen him, and we chit-chatted for a minute. I don't really remember what we talked about, but at some point, the conversation turned kind of sinister, and I do remember him saying, I can do anything I want to you. And I was, you know, being a teenager, like, oh, whatever, you can't touch me. And as I'm leaning back, he went and grabbed me through the door I had opened. And, you know, I'm pulling against him, trying to get out, and he's pulling me forward, and it kind of knocked me off balance. So he was able to push me down and put me somewhere between the doorway that I had opened and the ground. And he had essentially stuck his hand down my shirt and down my pants, just as a really gross display of power. That's all he really wanted. He just went, fondled for a couple minutes, and then pulled his hand out and said, yeah, like I thought, and walked away. Mm. So after that, I kind of closed the door and locked it, put the bar in, and I just felt so gross and kind of dirty. But at the same time, I didn't feel like there was anything I could do. Because, you know, at 12 years old, you know, one, your parents told you not to open the door for strange boys anyway. And even though this was a boy that I technically kind of knew, I didn't really know him. I didn't even know his actual name. I just knew him by a nickname. In the book, he's called Puffy because he looked like Sean Combs. But
and how did it affect you?
It made me a lot more hesitant in terms of sexual encounters with the opposite sex. It made me a lot more cautious around men that I did not know. And so while there aren't really, you know, I was still able to go on and have other sexual relationships, it's a lot less free than I would have been had that not happened. And then the weird part in my essay is that...
Here's the sequel.
Yeah, here's the sequel. A little later on in that same year, six boys around my neighborhood were arrested for gang rape, and they were all being tried as adults. One of them was my friend T. And so we heard
the same guy.
Yeah, it was not the same guy that molested me, but it was the guy that he had come and asked for. This friend who had never done anything to me, who I didn't even know would have done something like that,
yeah,
was arrested for this gang rape. So, you know, I'd heard about it, and it was, you know, big news in our neighborhood because we couldn't believe that someone we knew would do something like that. But, you know, after a while, we stopped hearing about it, and I stopped thinking about it.
Which really must raise issues of who can you trust.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because there's so much complicitness in, you know, in these actions, particularly among guys that you would consider male friends who wouldn't necessarily speak up. When I was 16, I was doing a mock trial for my school, and I had to go out and observe a court trial. And so just by strange fate, we ended up in the last court trial of one of the last six rapists,
mm-hmm,
for the gang rape that happened in my neighborhood. And when I looked on the wall, they had every single person's picture on the wall, and I noticed there was my friend T, and there was that guy Puffy, my not rapist, who had gone on to gang rape somebody else.
So he did wind up,
mm-hmm,
actually raping somebody. That, what a creepy feeling that must have been for you.
It was horrifying. It was absolutely horrifying to sit there in that courtroom and look at those pictures and to see that person. And I started, you know, as I said in the book, I started really thinking like, oh, my gosh, could I have stopped this? Should I have tried to say something? Should I have tried to speak out? And the worst part that came for me was when the defense attorney came onto the into the courtroom and started talking about his client. And one of the things that he had said was that even though there was no issue of consent in this case, this girl was brutally beaten, gang raped, sodomized, left unconscious. You know, and they had the before and after pictures of this girl, and, like, you can't even recognize her face.
Mm.
Like, she was literally beaten to a pulp. I've never seen that literally before until that day. And the defense attorney started going off about, you know, you will hear that, you know, X is not such a nice girl after all.
Oh.
You know,
mm-hmm,
you will hear that she skipped school and went home with two boys she didn't know to smoke marijuana. And it's like, why are you even bringing that up when consent isn't even an issue in this case?
Did they all get convicted?
Ultimately, five of the six got convicted. I'm not sure what the outcome of the trial that I went to,
mm-hmm,
was. because he was the last one, but five of the six got convicted, including what apparently was the ringleader, the person who essentially initiated the action and initiated the beating. He was the first one to be convicted because he was the one essentially... He was the one who orchestrated the whole idea, and all the other guys, including my friend and my not rapist, just kind of went along with it while it was happening.
LaToya Peterson, editor of the blog Racialicious and a contributor to the book Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape. Also with us, Jacqueline Friedman, co-author of the book, and you wanted to react.
Yeah, I mean, LaToya knows, you know, my heart goes out to her, and I have my own stories. But I wanted to point out that there are some things in her story which are very common and point to the dynamics we're trying to address in the book. One is the idea of who is a good victim, who is mm-hmm. a legitimate rape victim, and that really the culture sees a good victim, one where we need to seek justice as someone who is a virgin, almost always white and skinny and pretty and young, you know. And anyone who deviates from that standard, their worthiness as a victim gets called into question by the culture immediately, and that's one of the things we're trying to question with this book.
So here's a, I guess you could call it a good victim question on our website. Somebody writes, if I go out and drink and get mugged, while the mugger should absolutely be punished, it was pretty stupid of me to start with, right?
You know what? There's a lot of stupid things we do in life. Almost everything that's fun has an element of stupidity to it. We need to be able to live our lives and go and have fun experiences sometimes. So I honestly really hate that argument. And my essay is called In Defense of Going Wild, which is about how women are told not to do these stupid behaviors. But the truth is, we do these behaviors. We go out and party with our friends. We have sex, God forbid. You know, we do these things because they're fun. And telling people that they're risky is never going to stop them from doing that, because that's part of life, is risk.
Talk more about your essay, In Defense of Going Wild, or How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love Pleasure, and how you can too.
The essay is basically about this model, which is inherent in every drinking and rape girls beware story, which is girls need to police themselves. They need to not seek out, you know, parties or drinking or sex. You know, they need to not dress skimpily. We all know what those messages are, because they might get raped. Now, first of all, that erases all responsibility from men, mm-hmm. who really are the key. And, you know, without the man, without the rapist, there's no rape. They are the key in this scenario, and they're almost always erased from that conversation. And second of all, telling girls this isn't going to work. All girls know this from the age of 3. You know, we see it on Law and Order. We see it everywhere. Our mothers tell us, you know, we need to be careful. But do we all go out and do it anyway? Sure, because it's fun, because it's part of life, and because pleasure is an essential human right. And to tell half of the population not to seek it because another half of the population might harm them is really a violation of our human rights.
Moral of the story, as you write it in the essay, quote, rape is not a risk inherent in unregulated partying or sexual behavior.
Right. Rape is a risk inherent in being female in this culture, and that's what we're trying to change.
Because now, the blogosphere erupted back in 2007 after a handful of people started talking about something they called gray rape.
Ugh.
Is gray rape different from not rape?
I'll let LaToya give her answer in a minute, but I don't think so. I think the problem, I think that it is. I think that the construction of gray rape is that it's a rape. It's a sexual assault or a rape in which the woman is not sure if she should feel guilty or not, if she had some responsibility. But I got to tell you, that's like 80% of the rapes, because we live in a culture, because of all those not rapes that LaToya was talking about, where women are taught not to know their own sexual desires and not to want sex. And so if we're always confused about whether or not we're supposed to want it or if we're bad to want it, then rape is confusing.
When you talk about the culture making it a risk for 50% of the population at the hands of the other 50% of the population, obviously it's overwhelmingly men who rape women. But do you think the culture is really so soft on it? I mean, doesn't the mainstream culture in the United States see rape as one of the most horrible things that anybody could do to another person?
They do.
You know, oh, Jacqueline, can I answer this?
Yeah, go, LaToya.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I notice happening, the same way kind of rape overlaps with a bit about racism, is that the naming the act has become so important and so paramount that people who are actually taking these actions find it worse to be labeled in that way. So, you know, one of the responses that I got, well, you know, luckily infrequently, but to my essay was men going, you know, what about all the false rape charges against men? What about that? And those tend to happen fairly rarely, considering I think the most recent statistic is 17.7 million women have been raped or sexually assaulted in this country. People seem like they don't want to. They won't want to give the term this kind of power. Like, if you're going to say, "Oh my gosh, I was raped," it has to be beyond a shadow of a doubt this person's fault. You have to be, like Jacqueline said earlier, the perfect victim. So you can't have done anything at all potentially that could have brought this upon yourself, including getting bad grades or including wearing, you know, an outfit that someone else might find attractive, including doing anything in your power.
Or having had sex with someone sometime ever before. Yeah.
Exactly.
We're almost out of time, and then we're going to move on to a news conference that's taking place this hour. We're not going to cover the news conference, but we're going to talk about what Attorney General Cuomo is announcing today that's probably going to mean better health insurance reimbursements for you when you use out-of-plan doctors. Looks like they've discovered some possible fraud in this area. Are you surprised, people? So we'll talk about that in just a minute. But Jacqueline Friedman, before you go, you're out as queer. Do you think that the queer community is more tuned in to female sexual power?
I wish that it were. I think that the statistics are that rape happens between women at about the same rate as it happens in heterosexual pairings.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Maybe slightly less. But no, these dynamics get replicated in all relationships, unfortunately.
Latoya, any last word?
I just really want to stress that my essay really focused on women and getting women to break the silence, but we also do need to talk to men and let them know actually what's happening to us and what behaviors are not okay. Too often that rape prevention tends to rest solely on women, and we really do need to bring men into the conversation as active participants, as people who can help stop this.
Jacqueline Friedman, co-author of a new book called Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape, and Latoya Peterson, a contributor to the book and the editor of the blog Racialicious. Thank you both very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. To that health insurance deal in a minute.